session number 30304.
Serena Reel 34.
Well, I soon felt at home at Lucas and quickly forgot my disappointment. The station had a blessed compactness which Long Kesh had lacked and was ringed only by dispersal points for aircraft. As soon as I reported to the flight commander, squadron leader Tubby Sunnox, I sensed that it was a happy, efficient unit. He was a rather round, warm-hearted ex-World War I submarine commander who had indulged in peacetime aviation. He had a knack of exercising his authority in the pleasantest possible way. He looked on his unit as his own brood, and he resumed the few caustic remarks he occasionally made for the faceless people with carpet on the floor. This phrase referred to the fact that whenever he visited Air Ministry or a similar distant arm of the body politic, all but the most senior RAF personnel had no carpet on the linoleum-covered floor, but the civil servants' floors were graded, as were the occupants, from small rugs to larger squares to extensive and expensive spreads. Anyway, the reliable, easy-to-fly Anson with dual controls was the ideal machine for this kind of instrument flying, allowing the trainee pilot to concentrate on position and attitude of the aircraft in relation to the information he was receiving from his radar operator. The purpose of the flight was to put into practice the experiments which had been made in using radar beams to assist landings in minimum visibility. The Ansons were equipped with a radar set which recorded distance from the radar beam transmitted from an antenna at the far end of the runway, which also sent out dots on one side of the runway, dashes on the other, and a steady beam where the two met along it and beyond. A radar interpretation of the Lorentz radio system, which used radio beams in a similar way, now it was to be radar for both homing and landing. Needless to say, at this stage of development, the pilot was entirely dependent on the skill and clear thinking of the radar operator, and fortunately I had a very good one. Just as I was in approaching Reykjavik when returning from an ice reconnaissance in November 1942. And it turns out that possibly that was the first time it had been used for that purpose. The operator called left, left, or right, right, or steady, as needed, reading off the distance as the runway was approached. The pilot carried out the normal routines on the approach, adjusting height and speed accordingly, aiming to cross the downwind end of the runway at 50 feet, less if the runway was very short or more if the conditions were turbulent. The radar operator's expertise became apparent in the finer interpretations of the aircraft's position, such as correct estimates of fractions of a mile and the point at which the position of the aircraft within the beam was close to the adjoining zone. He would be the first to recognize the effect of unexpected drift, giving graded instructions to counter it. And, of course, in modern times, that kind of information is all supplied to the pilot or co-pilot of a modern aircraft. We found it necessary to familiarize the doubting pilot, and there were several of them, with our type of instrument flying in three stages: up and away, finding the beam, and down to hold off. The ensign had a hood over the pilot's seat, pulled forward to detach him from all but the instruments and controls. The best instrument flying revision was achieved without the use of the hood, in layer cloud with a base above 2,000 feet, when we could find it, when he would be instructed to go up into it and away from the airfield and other aircraft. Then, still without the hood, flying on instruments and in cooperation with the radar operator in this cloud, they would work together from the instructor's predetermined position in finding the beam. Perhaps we'd start off in the dash sector, recognizing which way to turn to approach the full beam, the steady sector, then flying along it at prescribed distances, adjusting to the heights needed at those points. And if the approach to the runway made in this way was satisfactory, at a height of about 200 feet, going along the steady sector over the runway, the pilot would be told to climb away along the beam until he passed beyond the transmitter at the upwind end of the runway to add to his knowledge of the whole of the radar layout. So by now he should have a picture in his mind of where the main antenna was situated, how wide the beam was, the steady beam, and the dots on one side, dashes on the other. So that if he had to go round again, he could carry on along the beam for the short distance between the far end of the runway and the antenna. And then having passed the antenna, the beam would disappear, and he would know exactly that he was that distance beyond the far end of the runway. He would then be asked to repeat the approach procedure, adjusting to the information being given by the radar operator, down to 100 feet at a distance of a quarter of a mile from the landing end of the runway. From that point, he would make a normal visual landing. I consider this routine important in helping the pilot to appreciate the need to interpret the effect of drift as soon as possible in the approach down the steady sector of the beam. And in the initial stages of training, pilots, when in the air, tended to discount the explanations previously given on the ground. And having been led by the radar operator into the steady sector, they liked to set the gyro compass on zero and keep the aircraft on that heading. Correct, but only in calm conditions or when the wind was directly down the runway. Allow for drift before flying a heading. A crosswind, of course, would cause the aircraft to move to either the dot or the dash sector, and the pilot's ability to appreciate the need for a correction upon hearing steady, fading, approaching dot sector from the radar operator was usually a fair indication of his overall ability. His mental calculations would be based on an image of the beam, which increased in width with distance from the source, and would include an estimate of wind strength and direction calculated by noting the time taken to move from the steady sector to the edge of the dot sector. A good pilot would quickly make a satisfactory adjustment, reset the gyro compass, and give every indication that he knew what he was doing. The less able pilot would make a half-hearted turn to try to keep within the steady sector and be forced to follow that turn with others, so that eventually his machine virtually wriggled its way down the edge of the steady sector. In actual conditions of very low cloud or fog, such an approach could lead to an unfavorable position for landing, particularly, we had to bear in mind, as many of the pilots were handling four-engine machines, particularly with these heavy four-engined aircraft, which most of the pilots would be flying when they needed to use the system under operational conditions. The third stage, as the pilots increased in competence, involved about an hour's sustained concentration under the hood, and it really took quite a lot out of them. I mean, so far as the mind was concerned, and needed reasonable weather conditions so the instructor could keep a check on other aircraft. He would be told to fly wherever he pleased, downwind of the airfield, and then the hood would come down, the instructor would take the controls, making quite sure that although a pilot may have known the position before being hooded, he would no longer know it by the time he was told to home on the beacon, then find the runway beam and put the aircraft into a position for landing. With the better pilots on the final approach, one could let them take the aircraft across the end of the runway and talk them down through to the throttling back and hold off before taking over to put the plane down. To the astonishment of many of the pilots as they pushed back the hood and found the Anson rolling along after landing. On one or two occasions, with the very best of pupils, if it had been possible to establish a perfect rapport, I actually had the satisfaction of talking him through to the landing routine from a good approach at 50 feet, so that he actually landed the aircraft whilst under the hood, that my left hand would be hovering near the throttle and my right almost touching the control column on my side of the cockpit. Anyway, 1510 became in effect a minor communications flight as well as Babs flight, especially for VIPs who had reason to expedite their movement around the country. And our ability to land in very poor visibility also led to some interesting flights. Throughout the spring of 1944, and until it finally capsized after a raid by RAF Lancasters, the old Lancs indeed, on the 12th of November 1944, the German battleship Tirpitz, sister ship of the Bismarck, which had been sunk in 1941, was a threat to Atlantic shipping from its shelter in the Norwegian fjords. In fact, the Tirpitz had been a prime target when circumstances allowed since April 1942, when Wing Commander, later Air Vice Marshal Pathfinder Force Bennett, was shot down leading an attack, thence to escape via Sweden. Photographic reconnaissance aircraft kept a constant watch on the battleship, flying many sorties from Lucas. And on one of these, in April 1944, after an attack on the ship by Fleet Air Arm Barracudas, a thick sea fog on return made it necessary for the PRU aircraft, a Spit, to land at Wick. I was dispatched to collect the film from Wick and return with it for interpretation at Lucas. My radar op couldn't see the far end of the runway as we took off, but the lights were on. We had no problem in climbing away across the coast. The light wind from the east was the cause of the fog. We eventually emerged into clear, beautiful clear skies over a calm sea on course for Wick. Picking up the vital material, on the return from Wick, we decided to home on the Lucas Beacon, went up to 4,500 feet over the Grampian Mountains, now covered in cloud, which had come in above the fog. We descended to 2,000 feet by the time Wally, the operator, called over the beacon now, and I turned out to sea, quickly losing height to 1,000 feet, followed by a wide turn down to 500 to line up on the runway beam. The fog seemed thinner, yet we saw little more than the nearest runway lights on the final approach. But Wally put me spot on the middle of the beam. He was still reading distance as we crossed the end of the runway. Whether he was still at the radar set or looking over my shoulder when he said, "Should be touching down now," was not for me to question. Once again, he'd done his job perfectly, and the PRU film was duly delivered.
You flew a number of communications flights around the country. What type of places were you flying to?
I once thought that if there was a need for a sort of Baedeker of airfields around the country, I could have published a guide for the airfields at Ballykelly, Banff, Beccles, Blackpool, Downham Market, Drenn, Fairwood Common, Finwood Gask, Houghton Park, Ipswich, Leesden, Montrose, Newmarket, Northolt, Euston, St. Athens, Salmsbury, Sealon, Tain, Turnhouse, Wick, York, and others. And on one particular occasion, I had to fly down to Newmarket. I didn't know why or whom, but we had flown some VIP people around, and on the 15th of May I was detailed to fly to Turnhouse Aerodrome from Lucas, which is near Edinburgh, to collect Lord Rosebery. He was mentioned anonymously in my briefing as the most VIP in Scotland. Apparently, it mattered little when I entered the control room to report. For as soon as I explained my orders, he came across before the controller could respond and simply said, "Rosebery, who are you?" I saluted in reply, gave him my name, and discovered that I was to take him to Newmarket for the 1944 wartime derby. The race was to be run on the July course on the 17th of May instead of at the traditional Epsom. He had entered Ocean Swell for the race to be ridden by Billy Nevitt. "I don't bother about that," he said as I moved towards the controller to give details of our flight. "He knows where we're going as the crow flies. Let's move." And move we did. It was as if the excitement of the race had already caught up with him. He gave the airman holding open the door of the Anson a fatherly pat on the head, missed his footing as he stepped into the aircraft, so that one foot was still outside. Like a born equestrian, the airman cupped his hands together in the approved help into the saddle manner and carefully guided the foot into its proper place. On recovering, his lordship returned to the airman with a "well done, laddie," and then, for I can't take the Scottish accent properly, of course, but imagine it, and then followed me up the cabin to the cockpit for an explanation of which instruments and which controls did what. I thought he was going to try to fly the machine. We made the flight in beautiful sunshine, with visibility only slightly affected by a faint heat haze. First, the southern uplands of Scotland, then much of eastern England was spread out before us. My passengers showed the interest in the countryside one would expect of a great patriot. He was sitting behind me in the seat normally occupied by the navigator. On such flights across England, once the course set had proved satisfactory by checking the first few landmarks, it was customary to follow earthbound activity rather than the map. And from time to time, the eye would settle on the LNER Express, hauled by a Gresley locomotive, the line of barges waiting to pass through a lock on a canal, a convoy of army lorries, a familiar airfield where the squadrons were obviously re-equipping with Lancasters, the bustle of the street market in a small town, the number of new tractors which were displacing horse-drawn farm implements, a field of sheep being rounded up by a dog. England, this England. And at predetermined points, one would look for proof that the course being flown was correct, then continue to enjoy the kaleidoscope on offer. Many villages and small towns were admired, but remained anonymous. On this flight, as soon as we were on course, Lord Rosebery showed an interest worthy of a Baedeker. As we approached a town nestling in the hills of southern Scotland, I heard a shout behind me, "Hike!" pronounced as a Scotsman would. I noticed it wasn't one of my landmarks, but a quick glance at my map confirmed it. We'd hardly crossed Hadrian's Wall before there was a tap on my shoulder, a shout in my ear, "Where's that?" and a finger pointing at the appropriate conundrum. Fortunately, I knew it was Consett from the steelworks there. My next landmark was Darlington, but before we reached it, I replied to another question by, in all probability, giving one town the name of another off the top of my head. From Darlington, we had the choice of following the main line or the A1 road to Peterborough, across areas such as the Vale of York, etc. On the return journey, where towns are small, and in response to taps on the shoulder, and this is the bit I wanted to remember and just slip there, in response to taps on the shoulder, questions and pointing fingers, I did enjoy it, but several habitations were renamed that day. So on the return journey, I flew a course which took me around some of the airfields in southeast England, testing radar beacons. And 2 days later, on Derby Day, the radio news that evening announced the name of the Derby winner. It was Lord Rosebery's Ocean Swell. I had a few drinks in celebration of his success, and the slight pecuniary advantage a wager had brought me, and tried to avoid thinking of him viewing his many horses with his aid and asking, "What's the name of that one? And that? And..."
When you were flying over the airfields, Was it obvious there was so many aircraft and so much activity going on?
Oh, it was really remarkable. It was heartening. Being one of those, not the few, but one of the relative few from the start of the war, and remembering the paucity of whatever we had, and there were still biplanes flying in certain places, we were lucky that so many Hudsons, for instance, came to coastal command as quickly as they did. And when there was a loss, it was doubly felt because it took time to repair it. There, we had shortage of aircraft. We had to cut down the number of sorties that we would have preferred to make. It must have been a trying time for squadron commanders to fulfill what was expected of them. And at the beginning of the war, coastal commanders under much more pressure than bomber, or not than fighter, of course, at the time of the Battle of Britain, but before and after that, some squadrons were down to only 50% of their allocation. And then to fly, to have the, not only that, but more or less the freedom of the country, in the sense that I was it was my job to go around, see so many different places, so many different, so much of the build-up to what we knew was coming in the summer of 1944, the increasing number of aircraft with black and white stripes on them to be used during the invasion, the security line beyond which you could not fly an aircraft unless you were given this identification without special permission, and as I had to go through into the banned area, shall I say, on one or two occasions down to Norfolk, for instance, to see even more what was happening on each side and the way aircraft were packed here and there. It was quite amazing and most heartening. And by then, I mean, everybody was confident. It was just a matter of when the war would be brought to an end rather than if. So, yes, it was great.
What was your next posting?
My next posting from 1510 flight was down to HQCC. Not something I might have chosen. I was quite happy with 1510 flight. I was still hoping that eventually I would perhaps get back onto operations where you had to pull a trigger or a bomb leader. But anyway, after doing this work with them, which improved my instrument flying as much as the pupils, I think, but it gave me great confidence in the instrument. I could say now, I would be just as confident flying inside an aircraft, never mind about the outside, as I would flying visually. It comes as a sort of natural second. Anyway, after 3 weeks back in the old routine with 1510, I remember the date well, because one does remember the dates when things are of consequence happen. The 27th of June, I was ordered to report to headquarters, Coastal Command at Eastbury Park, Northwood.